From multiple interior locations in Minneapolis or near enough, this is Nice Games Club, the show where nice game devs talk gaming and game development.
I'm Ellen Burns Johnson, and I make nice games.
I'm Steve McGregor,
and I make nice games.
And I'm Martha Croy, I too make nice games. For this week's episode, our topics are games and your internal battery, and finding your artistic voice. And so, if everyone is ready, let's start.
Mark, I didn't notice this before,
but
your voice kind of has a Matt Berry vibe to it.
You don't say.
And the way you said voice reminded me of Matt Berry.
I have a little bit of like a frog in my throat a little bit, so I have a little bit of the kind of, you know.
Yeah, that, yeah.
that came across a little bit more Ira Glass. Welcome to Nice Games Club.
Yeah.
Vocal fry your face.
Well, now I just want to do like impressions for this whole episode now. Like, that's the energy I'm feeling, is let's just goof off today. Like, let's not do those fun topics that are deep and interesting.
We did lose a whole hour. We got to earn that back somehow, if that's emotionally or chronologically. So...
what do you mean we lost
an
hour?
Just here rant. Because it's daylight savings, yes?
Oh, yeah. That's right. Oh, yeah. That's true. Boo. Yeah.
I think we've ranted about daylight savings before on the show.
Yeah. But well,
I hate daylight savings.
Likely once a year.
You hate standard time is what you hate, right?
No, I hate the entire existence of daylight savings. Okay. Well, okay. I think I'm here.
Strap in, listeners.
So it's nice to get an hour extra sleep.
End of story.
It's nice. But when you lose an hour of sleep, it is the worst thing in the world.
Mm-hmm.
I cannot.
Right.
It's so frustrating.
Yeah.
It's like
you're saying the gain, the hour gained of sleep that you get in the fall doesn't make up for the terrible feeling of lost sleep that you have to
exactly
endure in the spring.
Not even remotely. Like, you get, it's like one step forward and seven steps back. It's terrible.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's a psychology to that, that we have loss avoidance as human psychology. Mm-hmm. Like, we're more worried about losing something we have than getting something we want. And so that's why people hoard things. It's why they save stuff they should throw out, is because its value to you feels greater when you have it than if you don't have it yet. And so that can be a negative instinct, but here it's in full force because it just really sucks to wake up.
It really does.
And with needing an hour more.
Yeah. And I mean, as a result of that, you're likely to get less sleep, or you're not going to have as much time to sleep on that day. And
you're a real, you wake up as the rooster crows. And you're also very regimented.
Well,
so this messes you up more than, like, I woke up today and it didn't feel any different because I don't have that kind of, like, I kind of always wake up at weird times and don't get a lot of sleep generally. So,
yeah. Well, that's the thing. I woke up and I walked out and I looked at my oven clock because I haven't changed it yet. And it said 7:30. I was like, oh, okay, 7:30. Sure. Then I was like, oh, crap, it's daylight savings. I lost an hour. So.
Wait a minute.
Yeah.
So, did you actually sleep one last hour?
I think I kind of did one last hour.
Did you wake up to an alarm or just naturally?
Just naturally, I woke up.
So, you're like, you have like the ultimate internal clock. It actually updates for daylight savings time.
Well, yeah, I think so.
Wow. Very jealous over here.
It's a blessing and a curse. I got it. You can see on the camera. I guess listeners can't see on the camera, but I bought the sleep mask over there on my bed.
Uh-huh.
And I thought that the reason why I would wake up early in the morning, without my wanting to, is because I'm really sensitive to the transition between night and day.
Yeah.
That sleep mask is near perfect in how it blocks the light out, and I still wake up at the same time I always do. So I just have some weird clock thing my grandma says that she never uses an alarm. She always wakes up at like the time she wants to wake up.
Yeah.
So I must have gotten it from her or something.
That's wild.
I'm sure she's exaggerating a little bit, but like, I don't know. I can't sleep in past like 10 unless I am extremely tired.
You say this like it's just like a normal, like a normal human habit, but I'm hearing this and hearing that your grandmother did it too, and I'm like, you're a wizard, Stephen. Like, that's that feels like a superpower. Like, feels unnatural.
It's really nice when I'm trying to go to work, or I expect I have plans at 10 o'clock. I'll just go to bed and not have an alarm up, and I know I'll wake up at like 9.
Oh, that terrifies me.
If I have a meeting at 2, if I have a meeting at 2 in the afternoon, I make sure to set my alarm. Like, even if I'm definitely going to wake up at 9 or 10 or whatever, like, I am worried that maybe it won't happen. Like, I
okay. Yeah. Huh. Yeah. I guess there's a lot of benefits to it. I just hate it when, like, I stay up till 5 o'clock
because
I'm playing Civ 6 and I'm addicted or whatever.
Uh-huh.
And then I go to bed and I wake up and it's 8 in the morning. So that's when it sucks.
So to the matter of daylight savings time, would you prefer we went to standard time all year or daylight savings all year?
I don't remember which is which. Are we in daylight savings now?
We are now in daylight savings. So there's more sun in the evening, but the sun rises a little later in the morning.
Oh, yeah, no, I would prefer normal time, I think. I don't like daylight savings time as much.
Okay, well, listeners, address your letters, too, because most people feel the opposite. Because at least here in Minnesota, when we have 4 p.m. sunsets in the dead of winter.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, today, like, it's going to feel very strange, because we've all now gotten used to it. The I think it's now 6. Sunsets were 5 o'clock yesterday, now they're about 6 o'clock. So it now feels like, I mean, that's still pretty early, but
I may have misspoke. I do remember, I do prefer it being like darker in the morning.
Oh, okay.
So maybe in the opposite.
So that'd be, yes. And so that's the thing. So I actually heard this interview. Maybe I'll put the link to this in the show notes. We're wildly off topic, but this is still interesting stuff. I was interviewed yesterday, with a senator, who talked like his pet project is eliminating a standard time and going to full daylight savings time. And he was talking with the interviewer about like the efforts currently in the current Congress to do this. And every year it comes up, right? There's always a news article that you read every year about why we'd still do this. But he was talking about his history with the topic. And he said, like, you know, I added, because daylight savings time changes, right? It didn't always used to be now, and it didn't always used to be in the first week of November. The daylight savings part of the year has been growing and growing, and the standard time part of the year has been shrinking and shrinking as a result of like progressive pieces of legislation that this senator has introduced over the years. I didn't know that part. I just thought it was like kind of every so often somebody would get it in their idea to change it, but it's like it's the one man's crusade. Like,
wow.
And he's like, there's only 4 months left. We'll get rid of them all soon enough.
That's really cool.
Yeah. And then the interviewer had a really good idea, which is that like some states can choose to stay on standard time and some states can choose to stay on daylight savings time as long as they're the same all year round. And then just time zones will just be different.
Right.
If there's any particular reason why a industry in a certain state prefers one way or the other, or being on one side of the country, that matters. There's so little resistance, but there's a little resistance to changing it. And like, that seems like a good solution perhaps. I don't know. Next year, we'll have this conversation again.
Oh, we will. Yeah. I'm sure of it.
Ellen, you've got a little news.
What games has you been playing?
Yeah, well, I have a whole topic on like that's related to what games I've been playing for the last couple months. But I finished a game, and that always feels good. I've been playing like this. It's basically like a little puzzle room kind of game. Like, it's a series of puzzle rooms strung together, hundreds of little puzzle rooms strung together into multiple chapters in this long story. It's called Tiny Room Stories by Chiari Games. I think they're out of Russia. And I played it on Android, and it was really cute. There was some, got a little wild by the end. I think the story got a little bit stretched, but, you know, it was a fun design. So it was fun to play around with it and see what they were doing. So that was fun. And then started on an adorable game called Animal Restaurant, which is also something I'm playing on Android. And that's just like a casual, not much of a thinker. It's just adorable animals come into your restaurant and eat adorable food.
Oh, dang. I'm looking at it now. You ain't kidding.
It's so cute.
There's a screenshot that just has like a deer, a possum, and a dog. And at the bottom, it just says, manage the restaurants. It just seems like, so... It's so like self-evidently adorable. Like,
Yeah.
Yeah.
I hired a promoter cat that promotes my restaurant. And the way that this cat promotes my restaurant is just to wave his paws in the air. Like,
oh, the logo is genius. The logo, it looks like a logo to a restaurant. like a mid-range sit-down kind of place that you totally see.
Yeah.
Oh, man, that's incredible.
Yeah.
Wow, really good. Yeah. Really good. That's cool. I'm getting this.
Okay, good. Well, then you can come. Apparently, if you have friends that you're linked to, you can visit each other's restaurants. So you come down to my place.
I can come to and I'll give you Ellen's animal restaurant. Well,
that's... I think so. I haven't made any friends yet. So you'll be my first restaurant friend.
Cool. That sells me all the way. I love it.
All right. Yeah. You can come over to my restaurant and order some ramen. We just added it to the menu. Adorable ramen. Anyway, so that's been kind of fun. Once in a while, I'll pick up those casual kind of like, what are they called? Idle games.
Mm-hmm.
You just basically click it on stuff.
Yeah.
I don't play many of those.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm always like, when it's the right time to play one.
Yeah.
It's just like the right. It's like, I don't know. It's like getting a cup of hot chocolate when you're coming in from outside. It's like just the right thing at the right time.
Yeah, I always want to get into more of those because there's such a lot of interesting design happening in that space because it's it's free of a lot of the concerns a lot of game development has or game design has. And so it gets to be creative in a different way. And it's pretty interesting to me. But I kind of always just go back to like Spider Solitaire, like when I need something like that, like I go back to or play a crossword or something. Like I feel decidedly old fashioned. I'm like, why aren't I just playing interesting, clever, well-made idle games? Why am I just playing solitaire again when I need 5 minutes to relax?
Some of them are pretty exploitative, I think. Like,
those mechanisms.
Well, I mean, not to shoot down like the potential for idle games, because I think there are
how much
a lot
that ramen
of, like,
cost?
And there was, that was just like, that ramen cost.
lots of stars in COD.
I see. I played this idle game called Penguin Islands on my phone, and I was like, I love penguins.
Yeah,
I'll play this. And then I played it, and like you could get different penguins, and the penguins have different jobs or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And it was cool for a while, but like I just wanted to get more penguins with more jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually, in order for you to get more penguins with more jobs, you had to either, you know, wait 24 hours in order for your penguins to earn enough currency.
Oh,
to get
this thing.
Or spend money. And I was like, well, I'm done with this game now.
Yeah.
Right. Energy systems is the principle, right? I think that is kind of a line in the sand. I don't think I'll play any game with an energy system. I feel like that is, it's not a very creative piece of design. But also it's so transparent in what it's about that it makes the experience, even an enjoyable experience, it kind of just sours it. Like even if I don't intend to spend money, and even if I got plenty of enjoyment out of $0, I feel like, well, then I'm coming out ahead on this. Like just knowing that's there and having to engage the system like that. Yeah, I don't know.
For me, it really depends on the game. Like there are three games that come to mind that are kind of bringing up that system. The first game is Penguin Isle, which I downloaded and will probably play a little bit. But like within the first 5 minutes, it was apparent that those were the dynamics at play.
Mm-hmm.
And then another one, a couple that I've played, Tiny Death Star, which is like part of that Tiny Tower series where you just add floor after floor after floor.
Yeah.
Except for because I'm going to add another layer of nerd onto it. It was Tiny Death Star, which I loved. I still remember. I had like a whole gym where the Jedi were training on a treadmill. Kit Fisto was just like, his tentacles were like, anyway. And then there was Two Dots, which was a puzzle game that also had those dynamics. And that one sucked me in so hard. I had to uninstall it. Then I reinstalled it. I had to uninstall it again because it was just so, it was so good.
At
sucking me in. It is really fun, but but the dynamics are just really insidious in that way. Mm-hmm. And that like, it's, you really do get to a point where you have to pay money to keep playing, and that's fine. I'd be curious to do some research on this. Like, is the level of feeling that someone gets to, like, of discomfort with those dynamics consistent from game to game? You know, like, is my point of quitting for Penguin Isle similar to my point of quitting for Two Dots? And if not, like, what causes those differences?
Yeah,
Do I like dots more than penguins or,
yeah,
putting it on the list.
Okay. There's
definitely
some round table in the future.
There's an interesting quality of like, how much will you put up with just for something you really enjoy? And, and that's the part that gets me. It's like, I don't want to get on that train. Like, I don't care how good it is. Like, even if that tiny nagging feeling in the back that is like, that I have to fight past, I feel like that's a burden on me. Like, even if it's like the best, you know, economic model for a game like this, like, even if it's not exploitative ultimately, like, just the fact that it plays with those dynamics at all, I feel it is sort of a failure of design. But I don't know how fair that is. I don't know.
Well, I imagine there's an ethical way to use energy systems, but
I imagine so. I don't know the
yeah,
kind of
but
examples,
no one's
but,
interested
but
in doing it at
sure.
the moment. exactly.
Yeah, but I'm thinking even in that situation where I don't feel icky about it, I still don't like that kind of stress. In game.
Sure.
Right.
That's fair.
Yeah. This would be like the perfect point to segue into topic number one. But Mark, you also have an update and I want to hear about it.
Oh, yeah. So since we last recorded, I made a whole damn game engine.
What?
What?
So
we recorded 2 weeks ago.
I know. So actually, yeah, that's the interesting part. So
right.
listeners may know that I've been working with the Playdate, which is a little tiny handheld made by Panic, the company that published Firewatch. And it's a tiny sort of Game Boy-like handheld. It's bright yellow. It's this adorable thing. It has a crank and two buttons and a D-pad. So it's and a one-bit black and white screen. It's a very cool, charming device. It's been delayed because of pandemic reasons. And Panic's getting it off the ground, but I've been part of this developer preview for it. So I have a dev unit. I've been developing a game for it. And as I was, and it's a mini game collection that I'm making. And so partly because I want to play with all the different hardware of the device, right? It's very Nintendo feeling where it's got an accelerometer, it's got a microphone, it's got this crank, which is hilarious. And so you can do a lot of fun Nintendo DS style mechanics with it. And because, you know, I'm much more used to making PC and console games, I'm really enjoying playing with hardware. I used to do some mobile development, and I did always like that there was lots of cool hardware features, but I never found a lot of use for them. But this thing is so charming and conducive to gameplay features that I'm really, really excited to play with it. So I want to make a mini game collection. So I've been working on that, and I realized that, like, you know what? What I should be doing is I should be building the architecture of this thing, like how to move from game to game, how the main menus work. And then I don't have to do a lot of heavy design thinking for each of these things. I have sort of design documents for each of these six mini games I'm putting into it, but I haven't made a lot of progress on those yet because I want to have a framework first. Because I want to, like, what does the meta game feel like? How do they interact with each other? So I've been making this structure for this thing. And then about a little bit way through, having conversation with other devs on the dev forums and the Discord, talking about like the gotchas with developing. The SDK for this system is great. This is going to be an excellent hobbyist machine for people to make their own games. Like it's really, really, it's faster to understand and do like from zero than something like Unity or something like that. So I think that's really, really cool. But it also made it easy for me to take what I was building and turn it into a genericized scene manager, input manager, data manager, like a game engine. And so I realized I had that on my hands. And so I kind of decided, okay, well, I moved all that code into a new repo and I started making it as a game engine. And in about a week and a half, I had something enough to share publicly with the, with the other developers in the dev preview program. And once the playdate goes live and the SDK is public, it'll be up for anybody. It'll be an open source game engine, and I'm really, really excited about it. Partly because the structure of the SDK is such that I don't need to build a physics model. I don't need to do sprite collisions. I don't need to do. There's a lot of things I don't need to do because they're built directly into the SDK. It's very Flash-like in that way, where it's kind of all. You don't really need any libraries to make anything you want. But things like scene management, things like managing, like when you go from a main menu to a game, how do you change how inputs work? Things like that, you still have to build yourself. And so I realized, well, I can just build it once. And because I have a lot of experience with different Flash engines and with Unity, and I kind of know, I feel like I know, I have opinions on how these things should be put together. So I'm putting that into this project. And it's been a fun thing because it also isn't slowing me down on this minigame collection I'm making. I needed to do all of this to make my minigame collection. So Cool. It's been a lot of fun, and I can't wait to share it with everybody. But I just put it out for the developer community, which is still pretty small. So I hope to get a lot of feedback from those folks, and some sanity checks, because it came together really quickly. I need to know what parts are broken and what parts don't make sense and stuff like that. But I'm also really encouraged when this thing goes public and when this device comes out. I really think of it as it's going to be. I don't know how successful it will be as a consumer product that people buy games on, but because everyone can make their own games for it, I think that consumer, that person who buys a Playdate is going to want tools to make games easier to make. And so I kind of want to provide one.
Cool. Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah. So I'll keep listeners updated as that goes. But I probably won't have a lot to say about it until I can actually show it to you.
Are you like the first one to like develop an engine for the Playdate?
Yeah.
I know that people have been tinkering with it. But.
The community is really, really small. It's a couple hundred people. And then the people who are active in it is a little smaller. And that's how it always goes. A bunch of people have been sharing a bunch of cool libraries that they've been developing. But no one has attempted a scene manager or a game engine for it. And a part of that, honestly, is because the SDK is really good. It does a lot for you. This isn't as heavy a lift as even building like a Flash game engine would be. Or something similar in a object-oriented language or a framework libraries for Unity. It's a much smaller project, even though it does a lot because the hooks are all there. But just some of those the conversations I've had with people are like, oh yeah, I would love to be able to like have like transitions between scenes. And so I built like a little animation library of like crossfades and different things. So like suspend one scene, move to another, but then have like a transition between them without having to have both scenes loaded in memory. That's the kind of things you think about even when you're working in Unity. It doesn't do out of the box for you necessarily. And it's just a lot easier to like actually implement that stuff on a very limited small device. That it's defined by its parameters, and so, there's nothing else in the community like it right now. I do expect that when it's a public device, depending on how successful it is, of course, there will be a lot more people once they get their hands on it, building a lot in more interesting tools. But there isn't much yet.
Cool. Mm-hmm. That's exciting stuff. Yeah, I remember when I played Playdate at the Game Devs of Color conference.
Mm-hmm.
In the before times, I suppose. I remember that thing being really cool. But yeah, like I think it like the way you're describing it makes it sound like perfect for the machine. Like it's a hobbyist kind of like tool. And I think that'll be really very fascinating to see people. And hopefully like people can take advantage of the engine that you develop and make some interesting stuff out of that.
The other thing is it's I'm writing it in Lua because Lua is the scripting language that the Playdate uses. And I'm starting to like it. I didn't like Lua when I started.
Wait, what?
Lua is interesting. It's very interesting. It has a it's not object oriented, but you can.
Yeah.
But most a lot or many frameworks, including the Playdate SDK, graphs and a basic object oriented kind of framework on it. But it doesn't work quite the same way. And so like learning the ins and outs of that, but it's a friend of ours described it to me as like really interesting because you can learn you can memorize the entire language. It's a very, very simple. There's like no public private accessors. There's only like four types, primitive types. There's no difference between a number and an integer. There's tons of dynamic typing, which normally I hate. Like I hate that in JavaScript, but in here it's really interesting because there's lots of also type inference. So you can actually kind of work through it. I keep being tempted to use things like Hungarian notation, and anybody who's familiar with that knows that way lays danger, because you don't always know what you're passing around. But because of that, you don't have to do any type checking. You can have tables that have arbitrary entries, and that's that kind of freedom really speeds you up. And then it's all Lua itself doesn't have a compiler; it's all down to C in the end. And so it's still really performant. And now that I know how Lua works and what's interesting about it, there's tons of Roblox games are scripted in Lua. Tabletop Simulator is scripted in Lua. A lot of frameworks that people write things for use Lua as a front end for that stuff. And so, and this is a brand new universe to me. So I'm pretty excited about it. which is very much surprising. I've reluctantly learned this language.
Cool. Learning something new can be something that drains you, right? Because if you're going to learn something, really learn it, not just like expose your brain to it, it takes energy from you. It takes focus, and that can confirm. I don't know, Mark, whether Lua has been particularly draining compared to other languages. I'm getting the impression maybe it hasn't been for you, or at least less than you expected.
I expected it to be worse.
Okay.
But its properties make it easier to learn, especially if you do have experience with other languages.
Right. Okay. That makes sense. Mm-hmm. And expectations do matter when it comes to the difficulty of something. If you expect it to be just a grind and it's not quite as much of a grind, that can be relatively freeing for your brain.
Mm-hmm. It's a trick, but it works.
It is a trick. It's all perception, right? Mm-hmm. So that brings us to the idea of an internal battery. And the topic I wanted to talk about today was basically does gameplay drain you or does it recharge you? Mm. So let's back up a little bit. So the idea of an internal battery is that kind of basically the amount of doing that you have in a day or a given period of time. Yeah. It's your daily capacity for doing stuff, or your weekly capacity for doing stuff, or your ongoing capacity for doing things. Mm-hmm. And I mean that in the most broad way that I could possibly. It's like doing your work for your paycheck, going to the gym, going to your meeting, cleaning your dishes, thinking about the news, deciding which shoes to buy or what case to get for your phone or what you're making for lunch. Yeah, so all those things can drain you and other things can recharge you. I'm just curious, for you two, what kind of things recharge you and what kind of things drain you?
That's a good question. Because I feel like it switches a lot. You brought up games. Sometimes they can be recharging, but I found that that has even switched even during the pandemic. Literally during the pandemic. So Neo 2 came out a month or two after pandemic stuff started. Mm-hmm. And I borrowed my parents' PS4 and played that a bunch. And it was really nice too, because I would, in between stuff for work or whatever, I would go through a level in Neo and stuff. And Neo is hard, but it's very fun, and the combat system is very fun. And so that would help me feel a little bit better about coming back into work and then getting some stuff done. Mm-hmm. But then this year, 2021, it came out in on PC. And I was really excited for that, because then I could have it for myself and I didn't need to borrow my parents' stuff to play it. but I found myself not playing it as much, and I found it to be more difficult for me to get back into it the second time around. And maybe part of it is because I played the game already. And so it's you're just rehashing the same stuff, but there's new... I'm using a different weapon, so the content that I'm consuming isn't the same. There's new stuff that I'm seeing, but I'm finding it more difficult to get into, and it feels a little bit more like work. It feels a lot more like work than it did when I played it before.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's been kind of weird, but yeah, I don't know. I feel like it just switches for me, on and off. What works for me and what doesn't.
Okay. I think that makes sense. I don't think I would imagine that's a common experience, especially when your entire life gets reconfigured. And I'll come back to that later.
Yeah.
Mark, what about you?
I don't know. I've been thinking about this the whole time you were asking and Stephen was answering, how I would phrase it, but it's not necessarily the language I used to describe it. I don't know. There are definitely, I think we're all this way, where you can start a game and you can be like, oh crap, it's 3 a.m. And I'm like, how would I describe that experience? Because I'm very tired after that, but that's not, you don't mean that, right? You're talking about energizing yourself in a different way, not just running through the calories or whatever.
Right.
And it's kind of hard. I mean, I have a very addictive personality, so anything I'm doing now, I will do until the end of time, unless something else can get in my way. And so maybe I just don't have the cues to know whether I'm being drained or not with stuff like that. But I've definitely, there are games I've definitely played well past, you know, to get to a checkpoint or whatever, well past where it was a lot of fun. And that last hour of Assassin's Creed or whatever that I played that night is like, yeah. It's like I could have maybe saved that for tomorrow or something. And maybe that is kind of closer to the spectrum. This is not a good answer, Ellen. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
But I'm just having difficulty like how to, like, is it because I don't understand, I can't express it, or because it's the way I approach it? I don't know which is the case.
Or the question isn't phrased well, and that's okay. I mean, like, this is really looking for like precise language and answers here. Probably just the realm of some psychologists doing some studies somewhere. But I suspect that when it comes to like the idea of draining your battery versus recharging your battery, has something to do with execution capacity. Mm-hmm. You know, like your ability to take a thought and act on the thought, and I'm not sure exactly what that relationship is. I know there's some talk about like when it comes to extroverts and introverts, what drains you, what recharges you.
Mm-hmm.
I'm an ambivert, which means some in both category I find recharging, and some in other, you know, like some group activities are really recharging for me and energizing for me, and some are not.
Yeah.
And some solo activities are really energizing and recharging for me, and some are not. Which, you know, maybe it just kind of a point to like, usually binaries aren't the best way to capture the human experience.
Yeah, I was gonna say I normally, a lot of people, I guess when they meet me, they think of me as an extrovert because I used to like run a bunch of social events and things like that and be a part of social events. Like I would go out to clubs and stuff. Mm-hmm. But
I haven't seen you at a party in like a year at least.
Everyone's an introvert now.
But I lost my train of thought.
sorry.
No, it's fine. But like I find that I don't have a lot of endurance for that kind of stuff. Like I enjoy it, but like I feel like I go I burn bright and then die off pretty quick. But like I oftentimes will seek that stuff out, but it doesn't always like, you know, give me energy, doesn't fill up the battery. Mm-hmm. Whereas like sometimes I'll like stay home and like that feels nice, and then I'm like recharged and I can go back ready to work or do whatever it is, do social things and things like that. But other times like I'll be at home and I'll be just itching to, you know, see other people and be like, oh, I'm so sick of just talking to myself the whole time or whatever. Yeah. So yeah, it flips.
Yeah.
And I basically what I'm saying is the ambivert thing, I guess, feels more accurate to how I feel versus extrovert or introvert. I don't think I can really, I don't fit in between.
That's a good, I hadn't heard that term, but I know immediately what it means when you say it.
Yeah.
And that, that feels like everyone must be a little bit of that. It's just where on the line, right? And the both of you describing those things, like, oh, that sounds like me too. I wonder if it's a universal experience except for the thresholds and what triggers you to go on to one side or the other. But that really reminds me of like the gamer motivation profiles. Do you remember those? We did those a long time ago. Might be a good, maybe we should, the three of us do that again and maybe compare and see how that is. But what's great about that's sort of a personality quiz that lets you, that gives you a result as to what interests you about games. And it's pretty interesting.
Yeah.
But that I think fits a lot into what Ellen, how you initially introduced this topic, this idea of like what in games, not like what games or what conditions on the couch energize you or deplete you, but what kind of games energize you and deplete you maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think about like games that let you create or produce or progress. So games with that have a linear story, games that are creative, that let you create your own things. Those are the things that appeal to me. And games that don't do that, where there's more of a grind or I'm going for a high score rather than a final scene, those don't appeal to me as much. And I think that those are the kinds of experiences that even when I'm enjoying myself, like I would say drain me. So I'm coming around to being able to describe this in this language, I think.
Yeah, and I think you're getting to where I ended up, kind of close to where I ended up after I was thinking about this topic.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's been something I've kind of been picking at in my brain. Gosh, it's kind of a terrible visual. I've been kind of looping on this topic in my brain for a while because mm-hmm. I feel like I need to find a resolution for it and I can't. But prior to the pandemic, PC gaming was just like a big source of recharging for me. It was like I got to sit and plug in. I got energy from the system.
Yeah.
And lately I've just found myself like not interested in playing games on my PC other than like the tabletop simulator games that we might play or, you know, weekly sessions of D&D. Like sitting down and playing a game by myself, like mm-hmm. a solo game that's from my Steam library, used to just get me really excited. Like, oh yeah, I can spend a few hours doing this. And now I'm like, I'll have a few hours. I can do this. And it's just such a drastic switch. And it kind of just happened without me really understanding it. I'm just trying to understand it. I think also, like, I want to find a resolution for it because I have all these games in my library and I want to play them, but I don't want to play them when I have time. And Eric has taken over the Switch. He's playing Stardew Valley all the time. So I just wanted to think about, like, okay, here are these feelings I'm having. Why am I feeling them? And I think it comes down to a few different factors, some of which you were just touching on, Mark.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, why is PC gameplay draining my battery rather than charging it like it used to? Mm-hmm. And I think that it could be I just didn't download games that are in the genres I know, like, do recharge me. And that actually kind of plays into one of the points of that I came to.
Mm-hmm.
Because, Mark, that's what you just mentioned. Like, if there are games that types of games, types of dynamics or genres that you know play into your personal preferences, then those are probably going to be more recharging than others that are outside of that, you know, sphere.
Yeah.
But I think I have over the past several years tended towards purchasing games that are very unlike each other.
Mm-hmm.
So because I want to feed my design brain, I want to experience like a lot of different types of gameplay that are really innovative and different from one another. And that's not necessarily recharging though. Like that's might be a drain because I'm not really playing it for. Am I really playing it for fun? And this comes down to like the idea of intention. When you're sitting down to do something, what's your intention behind it? And I think I maybe have not been giving myself enough space to just have an intention for fun, and I've been giving myself basically homework, and that might be a big part of it. A couple other factors is like, my workplace, my play space has become my workspace because I work from home and I switched to being a freelancer. So I don't have an office space that I can go to. It's all right here in the same desk. That might be a part of it. And then the third piece that I really didn't think about until I asked Eric about this, he pointed out, you've got more games to choose from. You know, I've got a large library of games, and lots of them are ones I haven't played yet.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, when I'm thinking, what game am I going to play next? What new game am I going to play next that I haven't tried yet? It's like, well, choose from these couple hundred that you have. And also don't forget about those 1,600 games you got on itch.
Right.
Yeah.
And that just kind of, it's a decision fatigue or decision paralysis kind of issue. So that's kind of what I came down to. I don't know. What do you guys think? Does that resonate with you all?
Just on that last point, it's really interesting because those 1,600 the itch racial justice bundle from last year. Somebody built a website which will randomize so you can pick a random bundle game, is what it is. And I was like, there should just be like a local utility on your machine that does that with your Steam library. Where like I've said this on the show before, but I don't have an enormous Steam library. Like I'm not like apparently most Steam players. A lot of this is just me from the outside looking in, but when people talk about like having all these games, like a big backlog or whatever, my mind goes to, well, what tools can we build to fix that either within Steam itself, or more likely someone else building it, just to make that less burdensome, right? To make it more of a like, and then intentionality can be brought in because you could sit down, to not play a type of game, but sit down to be surprised and delighted, right? If that becomes your intention. And then you can even play a game you don't like, but in more of a sense of curiosity. And then you get it off your backlog or whatever. So like when you started describing this, it immediately became clear the thing that was missing from me kind of getting closer to where you started from is the idea you introduced, which is context, and those different categories you described.
Yeah, and then the way you're describing it, Mark, reminds me of how like I will sometimes go on Netflix or Hulu, and I'll be like, I'm really looking for a particular movie to watch, and so I will try to find that a movie that fits within that particular kind of movie because like that's what I'm feeling in the moment.
Yeah.
Whereas other times I'll just go back to Futurama or something.
yeah.
And watch that. And like it in that like. I think that like that happens with games sometimes too, where like sometimes you're just in the mood to try something different.
Mm-hmm.
I found personally that I generally speaking am not super in the mood to try a new thing, which isn't great. But I also feel, Ellen, in that like I am very interested in playing new games because I want to understand like the design choices that they made. Mm-hmm. Like people will be like, one thing I've always wanted to get into that I've never played is that Lord of the Rings game with the Nemesis system in it. I can't remember what it's called at the moment.
Shadows of Mordor.
Yeah, that's it. Shadows of Mordor. Because like I really wanted to see how the Nemesis system worked and things, but I've read enough about it and watched enough videos to know how it works at this point that I don't need to play it. But
yeah.
Even then, I'm still like, I should probably still play this thing. but like, I wouldn't be playing it because I want to play it. I'd be playing it because I want to further my craft.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know,
so that feels like a different purpose.
There, before I forget, recently somebody did a jam on Itch called the Nemesis Jam, which was with that. There's five or six games that ended up as a result of that. So you could probably tear through that in a night if you're really interested in like design expression.
That's good. Yeah, mm-hmm. And then they don't have to play a giant AAA game. That's a good idea.
I do that a lot. I find myself on deep dives on like fandom and YouTube because some mechanic of some game that came up is really interesting to me, but I'm like, but I don't know. I just find myself hooked in by that media.
Yeah.
I could just go play the game.
Yeah.
But like, I don't know. Sometimes it's that
fundamental identity thing. Like we're game designers. Like at a certain point, we're not gamers anymore. Like not principally anymore. And like that's, I mean, I tend to celebrate that fact, but like it also is kind of a bummer. Like, you know,
my brother will oftentimes like, I'll like criticize a game or something and be like, why are you looking at this like a game designer? You should be playing it like a gamer. I'm like, I can't turn them off.
Yeah.
Don't tell me that. Yeah.
Well, it also says being a game designer is fun. Like that's engaging for your brain. You enjoy that.
And that's
so, like,
why I'm doing it.
It's not so much a tragedy as like a just like you have to realize it. Like that's just how you approach these things. And
well, exactly. And yeah. I enjoy, you know, the like analyzing how the system works with other systems to see how this, you know, why they made the decisions that they made.
Yeah.
And things like that. Like I find that fun, even if I'm just, you know, playing the game.
Mm-hmm.
So. Yeah.
Why do I feel sad about it then? I feel like I've lost something, but I
well,
maybe,
it's,
I don't
well,
know.
I think it's like your innocence is lost.
Well, it's
maybe.
Like
yeah, maybe
it's what happens when you get your dream job, right? Like you can't have your hobby anymore, right?
Oh, you're totally right.
And so I think that's totally what it is. And that's the goes back to this idea of like draining your battery. It's like you're working all day, excited and charged up about this design that you're working on. And then you go and for the thing you want to have fun with, you engage that same part of your brain. And because you can't help it, because that's what you want to do. It's not like coming home from a job you hate and trying to do something relaxing.
That's so fascinating, too, because like before I got the job that I have now, I was working in a field that had nothing to do with video games.
Yeah.
And so like I would, I guess even at this job I was working at, I would work on games like on the side.
Yeah.
Mr. Vetti was cool with it.
Yeah. For the record.
and so like that helped, like I felt a lot, that was a lot of where I was feeling my passion and stuff. I was just working on games, but now that I work on games full time, I feel like I don't have as much energy to work on games as I did in the past outside of work, and even during work too sometimes.
And so, the world has been robbed of Sledgehammer Bride as a result.
Oh yeah, I do still think about that game very frequently.
Man, every time you've described it to me, I'm just, it's like, I want to see more of that. You got to get back to
it. I really want to work on that. And I have been thinking about, like, if there's a way for me to work on a game without, or like work on a game, but not like, I guess I like have a career that has nothing to do with games and work on games on the side again.
Yeah.
I don't know if that makes sense.
It's tough.
I don't know if that makes sense for me either.
I believe that, I mean, there is a lot of discussion on this topic because it happens to everybody. Like, you know, people who are artists who go into graphic design, who, you know, are filmmakers who work in commercial video. Like, it happens to so many creative people. That there should be a lot of resources for you to mine for how people coping strategies for people. Maybe we'll dig around and put some in the show notes. And if you don't find any, it's because we were lazy about it. But should be easy to find.
Yourself. Our batteries were drained.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Our batteries were drained. Yeah.
I will say that's what actually I was going to bring this up. This will come up next week because we're going to be doing a nice games jam. For our next episode, which we're recording today, but listener, you'll hear next week. And I've been dreading it actually because we've been doing RoBoston these past 10 weeks, and I'm like, I feel like I'm done with that. But we do it, so I'm actually very curious how we manage working in that format on a different thing. Like, I'm actually quite curious, but also a little bit like, okay, I don't know if I got the energy for it, you know?
Yeah, it takes a different kind of energy.
Go pound a monster after the session. Go pound a monster.
Hey, folks. Do you tweet?
Yes, sometimes. Mm-hmm. I'll be tweeting mostly.
Yes, sometimes I do tweet.
Okay. So basically, you have no excuse to not follow at Knights Games Club. Now, why would you want to do that? Other than there is no excuse not to, which is good enough. But if you need another reason, I will placate you. We have a couple reasons. One, Dale runs our Twitter account, and Dale is way cool, right? There's evidence of that all over the place. I don't need to recount all of it. Also, you're going to get really interesting game dev content. We talk about what we're doing on the show, but also Dale scours the Twitterverse and retweets a bunch of cool game dev stuff. The third reason is that it is there's lots of silly stuff also, things like jokes and cats and the things you're on the internet for in general. You can have curated by super cool Dale mixed in with a bunch of really fun game dev stuff. So if you want to follow Nice Games Club, and of course you do, at Nice Games Club, give us a follow, hear more about the show, hear more about other fun stuff. And now I'm getting kind of aggressive about it, but maybe I should cool down a little bit. Like,
I mean, I follow Nice Games Club.
Oh, well, then that's cool. Then I feel better. So if you want to make me feel better, because again, no excuse not to.
I'll go do that right now, not like I wasn't before.
Commit to the bit, Stephen. Commit to the bit.
That was this topic. Here's this new topic. we can't.
I'm not convinced.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. I'm just gonna start. So I've been thinking about. I mean, I guess we talked about this a little bit on the last episode too. Like how people when they like I'll look at other games and I'll like see how people came to the decisions they made. I'm trying to determine like why they decided that this mechanic needs to be in this game and such like that. Mm-hmm. I've also been thinking about that in terms of like games I want to make. Like, you brought up Sledgehammer Bright, which is really, man, I really want to make that game one day. basically what I'm trying to come to with this topic is I want to question all of us here in the clubhouse, but also people listening, where you find your artistic voice and what your artistic voice like is.
Mm-hmm.
That's one thing we definitely say on the show all the time, is that any game you make is going to be unique because you are the one making it. And I still strongly believe in that. But I do think that like there are ways that like you can better communicate like ideas that you want to communicate, or ideas that like you have in your head that, you know, or you're trying to communicate to people through game design or art or music or what have you. And so I guess I just wanted to bring to the table, like, everyone here, what do you feel is your best way to communicate your artistic voice? And like, how did you discover upon that? It's a weird.
Well, let me ask you a clarifying question first. When you say artistic voice, do you mean like, what am I in this for? What do I want to say? Or my artistic voice, and like, how do I want to express it? What is my, what is my method or technique, or independent of the thing I want to say? Like, is it both?
That's good. I would say it is both, but what I'm leaning towards, at least in the context of this question, is like, how you're expressing the ideas that you want to express.
Yeah.
More so. I think like what you want to express is part of that in some ways.
Right.
But yeah, like the how, I think, instead of the what.
Mm-hmm. Ellen, take it away.
Gosh, I don't know. I'm so just wrapped up in Steven's original question, like, and then I thought about your. This is so deep, you guys. This is layers of the onion here.
We're in it, yeah.
I don't really know. I feel like I don't know if I struggle with this.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I honestly don't. I'm struggling with the question.
Yeah.
I'm not struggling with the idea. Like, I just, if I want to make something, I just make it.
Yeah.
And it's usually bad, and I don't care. Like, I just, like, even if it's not necessarily games, like, I really care about the craft of game design, and I do try to make sure that the things that I create in that sphere and also, like, in any interactive design are thought through well. But for any other creative or artistic thing that I want to do, like, I don't know much about it. I don't ever let that stop me. It's just, like, I have this idea, and I need to see it realized.
Like, you're not your own art critic. Like, you don't need to interrogate it the way someone who views your work might be interested in interrogating its construction or its development.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't struggle with, it's just there. I don't know. It's just there, and it's clear.
That's super fascinating to me, because I have that problem where I get in my way. That's my therapist is describing it. And I'm describing it now. Like, it's, I tend to like think that I have to think things through before like it could be put on the canvas, quote unquote. Because like I want it to be right, or it feels like a perfectionist thing, but I think it's more like an excuse for me to not do it more could so. Because it's like, I don't want to do all this work. It's too much effort. Even though I want to do it, and I'll get a lot of fulfillment out of it.
Yeah.
I'm like, I'm cool where I am. It's like, I think it's like a protection mechanism, and it's something I'm trying to work.
Right. It's risk avoidance, right?
Yeah. Risk avoidance. Yeah. Like that.
Emotional vulnerability. I mean, to build something and put it out in the world is it's very much an act of emotional vulnerability, which opens you up to all kinds of pain, even if it's just like, no one ever sees it. It's still
But like, you'll still see it, and you're kind of opening yourself up to it. You know?
Emotional
vulnerability like that. And so, like, I think maybe part of the question I am asking is like that aspect. Like, how do you get over that? Part of it is how do you, you know, express yourself, and how do you how do you go about doing that? But also, like, how do you actively do it? That was a weird, like, the action and the act and the how.
Yeah. Well, I think there's a couple of components, right? Like, one of the things that I think I feel I benefit from is the separation of the what I want to say and the tools I need to say it, like, and not tying them so close together. I think there's a lot of artists who are actually quite good at binding those all up together. I think that's a perfectly reasonable way to work. But I feel I benefit from being able to say that, like, it allows me to investigate and learn more because I'm not scared of, can I make this thing in this way? I'm like, I start making it and then, or I start going for it and then decide how, what way as I go, because I know I can learn it as I, as along the way. And mm-hmm. so I feel like that it's like, ultimately it's just like finding useful strategies, is the one half of it. The other half of it is just knowing yourself, right? Is, this is sort of circular, but like, finding your artistic voice is easier when you sort of know a little bit of it already, right? But then also still being open to, and we talked about this when we were making Robustin, like, it ultimately it is what it is, right? It's not a choice you're making to it is what it is. You make little choices along the way, but what it ends up to being is what it is. And so you don't have to worry about hitting a target necessarily. A final, like, if this is a thing you want to say, or this is a unique take on a topic or a feeling or even just an idea, mm-hmm. you don't necessarily have to worry. You decide what to care about, what not to care about, but it's freeing and allows you to explore and be open to and less stressed about your work if you're comfortable letting it be what it becomes.
But you
do need to have some strong, like, principles and artistic notions. Otherwise, you can end up making something totally off what you'd expect to, and then not caring that it has nothing to do with your opinion or your view, your message. Your voice is useful, but it needs to say what you want to say. I don't know, I feel like I'm sort of contradicting myself now, but it all lines up, I think. I think it's back together.
Okay. No, I think what you're saying, it's a bit of a teeter-tottering you got to do. I don't know, a little bit of that sort of, I think it is important. Like, when you're making your game, you're making it, but you're also, like, discovering what the game is.
Yeah.
As a result of that. But if you discover that the game is not what you want it to be, then you can make changes and put it more in line with what you want it to be.
Yeah.
If that's what you want to do.
And recognizing that point is like, if you've got something really hot, really, it's like, it's on fire, it's doing great, it works too, players love it. But then you realize, wait a minute, this isn't the thing I want to make, even though it's working. Right. Then, like, that's that's a dangerous crossroads. And if you don't know what you want, if you don't know what your feelings are, what you want to express, if you don't know yourself as an artist, then you can just start making stuff. And then it can be great, but it won't be true to distill it into aphorisms, you know?
I'm realizing something about myself through this conversation. Mm-hmm. And I think that is that, for me at least, the artistic component of making is really about the process of making it.
Hmm.
Yeah.
The thing that I like to do is not end up with a result, you know, like, that's not the most, it's almost like the least rewarding part of the entire thing. The thing that I love doing is building things with people,
mm-hmm.
with teams of people, or just build the process of building things is so rewarding in and of itself that if it ends up being something completely different than I expected, that is okay, because I had the experience of making the decisions that resulted in that difference. And
right.
That almost come like those decisions are present in the work, even if they're not apparent to viewers or consumers of the work. They're still part of the journey that piece took from its conception to its realization. Yeah. And for me, the thing that's fulfilling, like, emotionally and artistically, is that journey, not the product.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. You when you say it like that, you sound like an artiste. You know the feeling I'm saying. I don't know that it's the correct word, but discover. I mean, other people describe it this way too. Like, when they're making a game, they're finding the fun.
Mm-hmm.
It's not exactly what you're saying, Ellen, because like you're what it sounded like to me is that like you are enjoying the process, and so the result is not. The result is not as important as the process to you. You don't find as much value in the actual the project at the end.
It's not what I have in mind. Like, I have the vision in mind for the final product. But for me, like, the thing that is, like, art, if you want, if you believe that art should challenge you and should help you grow, the thing that I find most helpful is the process of developing it to that end. Yeah. You know,
That's good.
Yeah, and you maybe have to that's find what part of it you care about, right? Because Ellen, I think you and I differ on that. Like, because I feel I have a lot of investment in using a medium like games or anything to as a delivery mechanism, right? That matters to me, and it isn't always going to end up exactly how I want it. Obviously, like, you know, things change as you go, like we've both been describing. But that's really relevant to me. But that's just relevant to me, right? And the work that I'm doing. And I think it's really important to recognize not just what is important to you, but really pin down what's not important to you. And so you can know when to be freer and open with that stuff. So you can try something that is different and scary because it isn't going to do any damage to your ultimate goal, right? And letting those things be what they're going to be. I think a lot about, like, there's certain sort of player emotions that I want to make all the work I do, and certain things that I'm very specifically want to stay away from. And one of the things I really don't like is intense competitive spirit. Like, I don't like that in games that I play, and I don't want to make games that invoke that. And so I'm very wary of doing things like adding leaderboards to a game. Even though that's an engagement mechanic, like I would step back from that. It would hurt the game's success, but I feel like I'm very nervous about what that does to things. But I'm also Metro Nexus is a competitive game, and I didn't set out to make it a competitive. It's just as I was developing it, it ended up making a competitive mode helped me test and build other things, and then it was fun, and I became interested in it. But I still had to hold on to how I am going to make a thing like that. But I decided I didn't actually care about it doesn't need to be a co-op game, right? A multiplayer thing. I didn't care that much about it. I had to recognize that, like, my feelings on that subject were more precise, and I could be more open to letting it be what it becomes through process. And I think, Ellen, you have probably a much more, like, you have a thousand flowers can bloom in your process because you're more interested in exploration, I think, than I probably am. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and I don't know. I think that's what makes us a good team. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm thinking back to some of the decisions that we've all made on Widget Satchel, which is like, and I would come up and be like, well, what if we did this? And you'd be like, well, but here's the thing about this game. It's like, this is where we come back to the vision and the story we want to tell. And I'd be like, yeah, you're right. That doesn't fit. Or like, okay, it doesn't fit. But if we made this change, it would be fun and it would fit.
I would have never come up with that, right? Because I wasn't able to go out on a limb to find that, right? Because I was too afraid of falling off the tree.
Right? Maybe. I don't know. Maybe. I just think that there's some value, you know, when you're working with a team, to have people who are coming from maybe a different.
Yeah, that's a really, really good point. Tree. Yeah. And finding your voice isn't necessarily always about you, right? It's about how you interact with collaborators and with players and with everything, right?
What part are you singing in this choir?
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, that's good. Yeah, I think I align more with, like, how you think of it, Mark. Like, but I think I need to, like, I'm realizing now too that, like, part of the problem I'm having with, like, you know, actually starting projects or feeling excited to start projects is I'm dreading the actual process of making the thing. I've said this on the show before. My the favorite thing I like doing in games is with the balancing and the game design and the tweaking of stuff to get it just right. That's super fun. I love that stuff. Mm-hmm. But in order to get to that point, you have to actually, you know, make the game.
Yeah. So, man, that was a struggle on RoboSTON because every time I'm like, oh, we're not to Steven's fun part yet. And we honestly didn't, we obviously never got there, really, to where you were able to take a time. That's true. That bothered me because I know that's something you wanted out of the experience. And I don't think you got enough of it. You didn't seem disappointed.
Yeah, I didn't get to do a lot of balance work and stuff. I mean, the With actually, that's a good point. Like with Robosson, I was comfortable with it going in whatever direction it ended up going because, mm-hmm. like, we established that right away.
Yeah.
And like it's not our full time thing. So like, if we don't have enough time to get to the balance stuff, then we didn't have enough time. So I didn't feel like resentment for on the project or anything for that. And we did do a lot of like, mechanics changes and stuff, and that tweak that
that's still part of that universe for sure.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, like I didn't get to do a lot of spreadsheet balance work mm-hmm. that I wanted to do, which is fine.
I can send you some spreadsheets.
It takes a ton of work to get to that point where you can start fiddling with numbers, and the whole thing doesn't fall apart when you're doing it. You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So like, I gotta like. I need to like reestablish what it is that I want from games and figure out how I can make it easier for me to make content. It's like one thing that I need to work on for work, because it's one of my goals I set for myself this year. Like we have to set goals for ourselves. And I set a goal to like make some prototypes,
mm-hmm.
for games at work. And I've had a hard time with that, partly because I'm working on Rhythm Rumble and like that's taking up a lot of my mind space, but also, the act of like starting from scratch on a new thing, it just feels like a bunch of work I don't want to do. But like a coworker I have, he makes prototypes all the time. Mm-hmm. Like, I want to like figure out how to get to a point where I can make prototypes, not necessarily as regularly as he does, but like,
mm-hmm.
More frequently and feel like I can do that better. Mm-hmm. And I think that like that's part of it is like with me, like the way I feel like I am best capable of expressing myself through video games. Well, I guess it is through video games, but specifically through the game design of video games, how I tweak the numbers, how I change things so that this character moves slower than this other character because there's a emotional burden of blah, blah, blah. You know, it's a mm-hmm. whole it's a whole thing.
That's the
world and the universe I live in and the world and the universe I want players to experience when they're playing a game that I work on.
Right, you like delivering the feeling of the reality of an experience,
yes.
right? And through like a you're sort of like crafting a scene with interactive values rather than like spatial values.
Right? Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So like and like that's the kind of stuff I really enjoy about making games, but it's like to get to that point. Mm-hmm. You have to do the other things.
What you need is you need to develop prototypes that are mechanically shallow, but have like sort of an inch deep and a mile wide, which is like an insult in some context. But I think that would allow you to express that part of your voice in a way that we can let you work it out, right? And so that when it comes time, when the bigger project finally makes it to the point where you can get your hands on it in that way, you can have a lot more. You're not starting from scratch in that phase as much. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like you need to make like a fighting game that is one button and it's just based on timing. that has like it's basically war. You need to make war.
Yeah.
But then give it a deck of cards with 1,000 suits. You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I'm saying this sort of cringing the whole time because that's very much not the kind of games I would want to make. But I feel
Steven had a big smile on his face. Just
I was like, ooh.
But you know what I mean? Good. And then you can find ways to make, and that could be the challenge you set for yourself is making a game that is mechanically shallow, making it engaging and interesting and give it a real feel, which is the thing you want to do. And if you can do that with something that has very little going for it, then that also becomes a proof of concept. For larger projects,
yeah, that's a good idea. I like that a lot.
Well, maybe that can be our nice game jam prompt.
Cool. Yes, team, please do my work for me. I really like that a lot. I'm gonna put that into practice because I think that like will be valuable to me. Like, mm-hmm. especially since like, we're working on mobile games now. Like, you, there's not a lot of buttons you can do anyways.
Yeah, so yeah.
Having a one button system is a cool idea.
Yeah, not just as a prototyping strategy, but as a real perhaps game design methodology. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, like Divekick's a good example, right? Of a game that like has very little. There's very little to approach it with, but it has a lot of depth, right. And it's by the part of it's a novelty. But like that's the kind of thing that you can use, and you know, and you can find your way there because you had to, because you can't make enormous games and put balance systems in it because you don't have enough time. But then if that's the reason why that's your voice, then that's the reason. We all have the real world constraints that give us, you know, when we make games as solo devs, for example, then that defines how we express ourselves in a way that has nothing to do with our intention or our desire. It's about the real world example we have. So. So not just as a practicing technique, but like ship some games like that. I think people would like them. Yeah. You know?
Well, and I think that's a good direction too, because like I do like, you know, I think I get a little ambitious with the designs of stuff. I'll like think of giant mechanical structures that like would take so much time for me to make that it's too daunting and I don't want to work on. If I'm just like, this is an interesting mechanic, make this thing and then play with that, then I get to do the messing around and the tweaking and stuff right away. And then like I can add stuff on, and then it won't feel so bad. That's good. That's good. Well, I guess the topic really was helping me find my artistic voice.
It's been a very therapeutic episode for you and me, I think.
Yeah, I mean, for you too, hopefully, Ellen.
Well, hopefully we'll be able to play this game of yours in time by the time of the next recording. Is that when you'll have a prototype ready for us?
Not everybody can make an engine in 2 weeks, right?
Hey, that's our show. Check out our website, nicegames.club, for show notes and links to resources on today's topic. We'd love to hear your thoughts on this episode and our programming in general. Go to nicegames.club/feedback and tell us what you think. You can also get in touch with us on Twitter at Nice Games Club, where Dale tweets about game dev resources and bad Kirby clones. Bad Kirby clones? Steven, is that a thing? Or are all Kirbys lovable and deserving of admiration?
Most Kirbys are. There's one that is not, and you'll find an example on Twitter.
You can also email us, contact@nicegames.club. Want to support the show? There are so many ways. Give us a review on your favorite podcast app. Tell your friends about your favorite episodes. Join us on Discord by visiting nicegames.club/discord. And now we are on Patreon. As a patron of the show, you'll enjoy bonus content, extra jokes, and more. Sign up, patreon.com/nicegamesclub. So until we start again, remember to
play nice
and make nice.